Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 2 of Phenomenal Physics, a sort of fairly low-key summary book on physics I thought I'd read, and it's sort of interesting to read. So after that, I sort of went back and checked some of the internet guff on physics, and truly, a lot of it's really dramatically wrong. So it's good to actually just read through this. Science in the Dark Ages, where, I don't know, page 22. By the 2nd century BCE, the prime position enjoyed by ancient Greek civilization had waned. This was followed by more than 1,500 years of scientific stagnation in the Western world. During this period, many of the great works of antiquities were neglected and eventually lost forever. Many important works were lost as a result of repeated destruction of the Great Library of Alexandria, which had been rebuilt multiple times during the first few centuries AD, Common Era. Fortunately, however, the key ideas from the period survived the destruction. Yeah, well, I think... yeah, it was a sort of a strange thing in terms of how the hordes or the the Vandals, the barbarians used to lay waste the land, and the Roman houses would collect up the top, fortified, and that eventually led to the monasteries and stuff like that. Okay, the fall of the West. When the Western Roman Empire fell, not only had Democritus' theory of tiny particles, atoms, long been discarded, but even the legacy of Aristotle, the greatest thinker of them all, was in danger of being forgotten entirely. The Roman world was not wholly without scientists. Ptolemy, for example, in the 2nd century AD, was considered one of the finest astronomers of his day, offering up incorrect, though still rather brilliant, Earth-centered models of the solar system. But Europe was beginning its steady decline into a period known as the Middle Ages, a term generally assigned to 1,000 years following the fall of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century BCE. Questions of science were no longer felt to be important. I think if you say they had a palette of ancient beliefs, and they followed rhetoric and grammar and logic and discussion, science waned. It's not that the other things went ahead. It's quite smoky here in I don't know where the bushfire is, but it's blown out away. When the Western Empire fell, even the legacy of Aristotle, the greatest thinker of them all, was in danger of being forgotten entirely. I don't know why they have that as a little bio thing. Light in the darkness. Fortunately for the modern world, world with growing Arab communities in Persia, Middle East, a few notable figures were able to shed some scientific light on the Dark Ages. That's, you know, I've got problems all with that. And the, I think the Muhammad specifying measurable, definable measurable things as to regulate the Muslim calendar sent them down the scientific path. The 11th century scholar Abu al-Hazan ibn al-Haytham, commonly referred in the West as al-Hazan, possessed a particularly brilliant scientific mind. He carried out some formidable studies on the subject of light, a phenomenon that had been more elusive than atoms to the ancient thinkers. Hazan is often known today as the father of optics. He is one of the first thinkers to utilize a truly inductive scientific method, one that begins with an experiment, develops theories based on these observations. Well, that induction is where you don't know and you guess. You no longer go to your pile of knowledge. You guess, you root round and find some other ideas. Al-Hazan performed experiments using lenses, mirrors, and produced some first calculations of light reflection and refraction. He also explored the separation of light into constituent colours using a prism. Although he is remembered in the large part for his work on optics, during the career of Al-Hazan, he also performed exciting works in mathematics, astronomy, medicine, and even psychology. It would be several more centuries before his work was known and appreciated by the West. It's really interesting about how the zero came across. I want to read that book again. Other Arab scholars of the Dark Ages. Al-Hazen was not alone. Ali ibn Isa is in the 10th century, obviously earlier than him, explored the optical part of the brain and made a highly accurate measurement of the Earth's circumference. Al-Bantani in the 9th century made corrections to Ptolemy's astronomical tales and made numerous contributions to the mathematics. Above all, Arabs and Persian scholars translated many Greek works into Arabic, thus preserving them for the benefit of the entire world. Al-Zain's book of optics, this is a little sign. Though Al-Zain is credited with being the author of more than 200 scientific and mathematical works, about half of which have survived, one stands out as the most memorable, the book of optics. In the work, Al-Zain describes optical phenomena in greater detail than had ever been accomplished before. Over the course of 7 books, he looks at how light travels, at how images are perceived of the eye, how light can be altered by the change by reflection or diffraction, and much more. It is truly a great scientific work of all time. What I wanted to say is that when you read these things, there's often paragraphs for what we would put in an equation, or there's often a page and that would be put in as a table. Or it sort of goes far the way, and then there's an argument. Reading Newton's Principalia is actually quite a grind. The first photographs. It's remarkably easy to take pictures today. Since the advent of digital photography, there is really nothing to it. Just point, click, review, delete, repeat the steps over again ad nauseum. The entire process takes only seconds with no expensive film is wasted. Looking back just a few years before the original digital technology, taking pictures was much more time-consuming, expensive process. Imagine then what it must have been like 900 years ago when the very first camera was invented by Al-Hazen. The first camera. Even in the 11th century, the Persian scientist Al-Hazen created a remarkably simple yet fascinating invention, a small room closed off to all light except for a tiny hole in one wall. The cone of light filtered through this hole to project the images of the outside world with the opposite wall of the room, as if a snapshot had been taken. Al-Hazen used these projected images as a basis for further scientific inquiry. It wasn't until the 16th century that artists began to use the device as a tool for capturing images of the world. Placing pieces of picture and paper on the canvas of the wall, they could trace the image that appeared inside the dark room, creating an uncannily realistic representation of the outside world. In 1826, French inventor Joseph Nisipi took the first permanent photograph using the principles of camera obscura and his own knowledge of chemistry. In Nisipi's invention, the image arrived at the camera and became embedded into a pewter plate. So pewter is a mixture of lead and tin. So it looks a bit like silver, but it's got none of them. It came covered with various chemicals, thus fixing the image. 35 years later, in 1861, Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell took the first durable colour photograph. He worked out how to make up an image. He took these shots using filters of different colours and then projected 3 different images on top of one another to make a colour photograph. The English word camera comes from the Italian Latin term used to describe a very fine piece of photographic equipment, camera obscura, or dark room. I don't quite understand. Camera is a room. Build your own camera obscura. We might do that. That's a bit hard for you to do in podcast land. The Renaissance begins. The Renaissance, the French word for rebirth, was a period of significant progress in both arts and scientists. This is the age of Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and many other brilliant original minds. This chapter introduces the groundbreaking theories of Copernicus, Galileo, and others, theories that help instigate the study of science as we know it. By asking new questions, these scientists began to offer real answers to establish the scientific method that we'll still use today. Let me see. Asking new questions. And to establish. Okay, Copernicus. Nick Copernicus. Nicholas Copernicus ushered in a new era of scientific thought with his words, De Revolutionibus Orbem Coelestium, The Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres. By asserting that the planets revolve around the sun, Copernicus brought about a true revolution in European science. It's for this reason that Copernicus is often credited as being one of the first to attempt to bring the science out of the Dark Ages into the Renaissance and the rebirth of learning. I don't know why they say that. That's just insane. Yeah. I think there's the starry firmament he's got here. The monastic astronomer. Copernicus is thought to have founder of modern astronomy. He was born in Poland in February 1473, and after his father's death, was raised by his uncle, Lucas Walsenrode. Copernicus never married, but devoted his long life to religion and a wide range of scientific studies. After studying mathematics and optics at Krakow University, Copernicus moved to Bologna, Italy, where he studied church law. His schooling complete, Copernicus returned to Poland to work as his secretary to his uncle, who is now Prince Bishop of Weimar. Now, you've got to understand that stage that Poland was part of the Latvian Empire. That was a big, huge Latvian Empire to work out. Though he had wide-ranging interests, including art, languages such as Greek and Latin, Copernicus also began to concentrate on astronomy. Because the telescope had yet to be invented, he had to make observations with the naked eye from a turret in the surrounding in the wall surrounding his home. Copernicus died in Frauenburg in May 24th, 1543. So, is he a really long life? I don't think so. He is. He died at 70. A frequently repeated legend is that his most famous groundbreaking book on the revolution of heavenly spheres was published on his final day, and completed work presented to him just before he died. Yeah, I think that may be a legend. The revolutionary idea. As early as 1541, Copernicus had been laying the groundwork for the heliocentric sun-centered theory of the universe. Although it did not immediately supplant the reigning Ptolemaic earth-centered system, it provided a foundation upon which later thinkers such as Kepler and Galileo could construct their own theories. It's interesting that he said that they also had to go in circles, not ellipses, because that was very much the Aristotelian view. It's interesting to know how much Galileo was deeply in bed with Aristotle. The new theory involved a system of 8 spheres or orbits based on a tremendous number of precise calculations compiled by Copernicus and published after his death. 6 of these spheres represents the orbits of planets Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn. The Sun is at the centre. The 7th was the outermost sphere, the firmament, upon which the distant stars sat. The remaining sphere was the orbit of the Moon, with the Earth as its central point. Yeah, so the starry firmament. And of course, then you've got Tycho Brahe and Kepler. Kepler is something I really find interesting to know about. I might read about him. Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler were brilliant men in their own individual ways. Brahe was insatiable desire to understand the motion of objects in space, which led him to make some of the most important measurements of the planetary motions, while Kepler, a unique mathematical mind, which interpreted tables of data and in order to find a consistent patterns in the midst of seeming chaos. Together, they ushered in the new era of astronomy and physics, the Noseless Dame. The Danish nobleman, Tycho Brahe, 1546 to 1601, which is 1601 is, you know, his contemporary with Shakespeare, all that type of stuff. The Danish nobleman Tycho Brahe became enthralled with the idea of astronomy at a very young age, impressed by the fact that astronomers, even as far back as the 6th century, could not observe but predict events. Could not only observe but predict events in the night sky. Brahe aimed to improve astronomy by amassing a huge wealth of observational data, but only after a rather riotous youth, which saw his nose his loser's nose in a duel, a famously sported false nose made of gold, silver, and wax. Harakal, a valiant dwarf, whom he kept under the dinner table, and domesticate a moose that later died after drinking too much beer and falling down the stairs. We only know this because someone wrote, "I'm sorry, your pet moose, it died when it went up the stairs and got drunk." After discovering a new star and publishing a book on it, Darko was given a hand, given land by by the Danish king, Frederick II, to build Uraniborg, the world's foremost astronomical observatory. He built a great equatorial amulet, a model of the celestial sphere, around 2.75 metres across. The great mural quadrant, an instrument used to measure exact locations of heavenly bodies, was 4 metres across. After a disagreement, Frederick Bray moved to Prague, where he was appointed the imperial astronomer. Bray never came to accept the Copernican model of the heliocentric universe. Instead, he chose to interpret the massive quantities of data using an Earth-centered model. He remained to be seen whether the data could support this view of the universe. Well, it's not one of the things is that he had Venus, Mercury, and Venus and Mercury orbiting the Sun. So he had a hybrid model. He was almost halfway there. The mercenary son, Johannes Kepler, Richard Wright, was born in Stuttgart, Germany, in 1571. Son of a mercenary soldier and innkeeper's daughter, who, it is said, was tried for witchcraft. A small, frail man with poor eyesight and remarkable intelligence, Kepler won scholarship, allowing him to attend the University of Tübingen. Young Kepler sought to combine Copernicus' observations with geometry he was learning at school. He followed mathematical clues to the device's own model, in which the orbits of 6 known planets lay on the surfaces of 6 spheres. Each could be fitted into one of Plato's perfect solids. Isn't that completely weird? Isn't it? So they're all obsessed with the ancients, and I didn't know that his first idea was that the spheres are heliocentric and fit on the solids. From the octahedron for Mercury's orbits to the cube for Saturn, although Kepler's theory turned out to be wrong, the model impressed Bray enough that he invited the young man to work with him. 18 months later, Bray died of acute urinary infection. His last words to assistants were, "Let me not seem to have died in vain." Oh, I don't think that's necessarily true, but they had this thing that you couldn't get up and urinate. That's one thing. Kepler was named Bray's successor as an imperial mathematician and was given responsibility for completing Bray's unfinished work. His superb mathematical skills allowed him to calculate the orbits of the planets more accurately, leading to the discovery that planets' orbits were not circles, but ellipses. Further research led Kepler to establish 3 laws of planetary orbits that would fundamentally change science, inspiring future generations of scientists, including Galileo and Newton. Well, it's basically Galileo actually rejected Kepler's law. Kepler said, he contacted Galileo at the time and said, "Look, they're ellipses," and Galileo said, "Rubbish, they're circles." Kepler's laws of planetary motions. First law, and I'm not going to go through them, because orbits of planets are elliptical. The Sun at one point, at one of the points of the focus of each one. Now, I should just read this because I remember reading this and saying, my God. Unlike a circle, which has only one point at its centre, ellipses have 2 centres of foci. Kepler realised that these paths of the planets were not perfect circles, and the Sun was the sole point of focus, but ellipses, with the Sun one of 2 focal points. What is the other point? Now, this is complete rubbish, dreamed up by this person. It is, in a sense, the overall gravitational attraction of everything else in the solar system, which combines to turn a circular orbits into ellipses. Complete and utter rubbish. Can you imagine writing that? So he says that the Sun's mass is there, and all the other masses sum up to being an imaginary mass at the other focus. is complete rubbish. Because the elliptical nature of orbits, the distance between the Sun and each planet, or between the Earth and Moon, is always changing. There are points along every orbit where the object or the body is close to the Sun. This is called the perihelion, and the furthest is called the aperihelion. Why you want to tell people that? It's important. The second law, the line joining the planet with the Sun sweeps an equal area of equal time as the planet moves the orbit. So this just means that the further away, the slower you go. And this is the way to measure the speed, the individual speed of an orbit. This turns out to be derived by gravity. You can derive that by gravity and a bit of integral calculus. Third law, the square of the revolutionary period of the planet is proportional to the cube of the semi-major axis of the orbit. Which is pretty interesting there. So it means that really the oscillation's periodic in one dimension if you look at it. And it says that if you take any orbit, compare any two orbits, and take the square root of them, you multiply the square root of the relative ratio of the square root of the largest orbit, and that will get you the relative time. So if I have an orbit at 1 AU, one atomic unit, that takes 1 year. If I take an orbit at 4 AU, it takes not 4 years but 4 times the square root of 2, 8 years to orbit. Or if I have an orbit at 9 AU, it doesn't take 9 years to go along. It's got 4, 9 times the square root of 9, which is 27 years. Okay. The principle is perhaps a little simpler when written out in the mathematical term t squared is proportional to O cubed. It's interesting to do, but it's fairly easy to understand it. Okay, phenomenal physics again, page 34. Galileo is perhaps the best example of the contrast between science practiced by the ancient scholars and those who took abundant scientific achievements of the European Renaissance. Galileo's achievements include further popularization of the Copernican model of the cosmos, a scientific explanation of the pendulum, the discovery of the moons of Jupiter, Galilean moons, improving the design of the telescope, and helping one of the first real scientific methods. I'm just really trying to think what was the Galilean moons were named after. I've got to really remember. The martyrdom of Galileo. This is a bit rich. The story is often told how Galileo angered the Roman Church by insisting the Earth revolves around the Sun. That's not true. Rather than the other way around. Most people have heard of the threats made against him, how he's forced to recant his views, and so he eloquently laid out in his brilliant book Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. Well, it's a dialogue, because that was the ancient way of communication. That's the way that Plato did. They were so in the ancient world that the people used to read the ancient dialogues, and so they said, write a play of it. Now, I've just got to remember what the Galilean moons were named after. Ganymede, what they were. I think they were goddesses or something like that. And he said, and yet under his bed, it does move. Look, if you actually read into it, he had a lot of funny stories. He didn't understand the resolution of his telescope. There's a whole heap of things. When you read it, it's a much more complicated thing. These words may be no more than legend. They are. They illustrate the popular idea of Galileo that he spent the final years of his life as a martyr to the cause of science. Well, this is true enough, but we must not overlook a life absolutely filled with remarkable discoveries, so many that it is quite impossible to mention them all here. Oh, God. Born in 1564 in Pisa, Italy, Galileo was what today may be called a true Renaissance man, for he did not limit himself to one field of study, but excelled in a great many. He was, like his father, a musician, a painter. He was also studied medicine in his youth. Galileo discovered the secrets of the pendulum swing, then using a primitive timing method using his own pulse of oscillation of the pendulum. He began performing experiments in motion, proving once and for all bodies of different weights fall at the same speed. See, right. He didn't actually use the Leaning Tower of Pisa to drop things off, which that's often showed. He used an inclined plane as a slow the gravity effect. In 1609, Galileo first heard of the new instruments invented by Hans Lippershey in the Netherlands, the telescope. By August that year, Galileo had not only built one himself, but had greatly improved on what on it. He went on to build some of the best telescopes in the world, which he used to view areas of space that no eye had seen. He discovered Jupiter's moons, the phases of Venus, the rings of Saturn, and much more. I don't think he discovered the rings of Saturn. And I think the phases of Venus were known before, but yeah, I just go through. Galileo's brush with the church did not occur till he was 70 years old. It's the publication of his dialogue in 1632 that caused trouble. Galileo was ordered to stand trial for heresy, leading him to recant his views. For the last 9 years of his life, Galileo lived under house arrest in his home in Florence, where he died in 1642. Falling bodies. For centuries before Galileo, it was believed, following Aristotle, that heavy objects would fall faster than lighter ones. Pick up a feather or a rock, drop the two of them, the rock will indeed fall faster than the feather. Galileo understood this is a nonsense notion and might be an illusion. The feather really does fall more slowly, but it's because there is another force acting besides gravity, air resistance. Galileo considered dropping two objects from the famous Leaning Tower of Pisa, but the air resistance would have spoiled the experiment. Instead, he rolled balls of different weights down inclined planes, ramps, and slowed the balls down so that the speed descent could be measured. Aristotle was wrong. The balls rolled down the ramp at precisely the same speed, no matter how light or heavy they were. There you go. Complicated thing. I think, Newton had a lot of problems with this. Pendulums, physics, I will go through this. Pendulums are remarkably simple devices, though they are not put to use frequently today as they once were. The most common application of pendulums throughout history has been the mechanism of a clock, where one might see a narrow rod extending the weight swinging back and forth or driving a complex gear within. What makes a pendulum so useful in keeping time? Galileo found a rather simple formula to explain the behaviour of the pendulum. Now, it is interesting that the fact that the pendulums didn't work led a French person to go say, Newton, what's the problem? And Newton then discovered gravity. From remarkable discovery. That's the real story. You've got the apple, or you've got the fact that Newton was trying, that the gravitational field was different over Earth. At any time, a string and a weight with an end swung back and forth, a pendulum is created. A pendulum consists merely of a rod, wire, a string fixed length from which the weight is suspended. Pendulus in Latin means hame. The weight is allowed to swing freely back and forth, carried along a fixed path by gravity. The time it takes for a pendulum to swing from one direction and back again is called the period of oscillation. What determines the period of the pendulum? Its initial speed, how hard it's pushed, the mass of the weight? Galileo discovered none of these answers are correct. In fact, the period of the pendulum is dependent only on the factor length, or g. Yeah. As the story goes, Galileo observed the swinging chandelier and timed its period using his pulse. To his great surprise, the period remained constant even under the even as the chandelier's movement slowed. Its period remained the time. Galileo suddenly had access to a simple device which allowed to keep time much more accurately than his own pulse. Within decades, Galileo's death, the Dutch physicist Christian Huygens had developed a mathematical equation to define the period of pendulum. It was no long before pendulums were partnered with systems, gears and moving hands to produce the first truly accurate timekeeping devices. My thing is that he didn't actually use the pendulum as a timekeeping device. Okay, Foucault's pendulum. The north and south poles should have a rotation period of 24 hours. This was confirmed by experiment in 21. This is the Foucault's pendulum. Foucault's pendulum. Which is one in Paris that should have. Should talk about the. I've got no what it is. A fantastic church I want to visit in Paris. Gravity, the very thing that keeps the pendulum in motion, also determines the speed, direction of the swing. In 1851, Leon Foucault created a massive pendulum, which is free swing in any direction. And as it did, it traced the lines in the bed of fine sand. After he set it in motion, Foucault demonstrated that the pendulum had turned slowly in a clockwise direction, the movement called precession. Since the vertical plane of the pendulum swings does not change once it has been set in motion, the tracing proves once for all that the Earth must be turning. I think that's very interesting. Coming over to René Descartes, I love him.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.